This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
On in the universe, there's a very rapid period of expansion. So soon after the Big Bang, the universe sort of inflates, so distances, scales in the universe expand exponentially, extremely rapidly. And effectively, that solved several problems in the standard Big Bang model. For example, why was the universe at such a basically the same temperature? So when we looked at the fading glow of the Big Bang, the cosmic microwave background, we found it to be almost exactly the same temperature everywhere we look. And that wouldn't have been possible since, you know, one side of the sky would have been so far removed from the other side of the sky at the time the cosmic microwave background was produced, that it wouldn't have known to be at the same temperature so precisely. So inflation basically solves that problem by saying that at the time, very early on, those two points, when we look now out to very large distances, looking back in time to the time the microwave background was created, points on opposite sides of the sky, as we see it now, would have actually been close enough very early on, very soon after the Big Bang, to come into this sort of approximate equilibrium to get the same temperature. It also solves a problem to do with why the universe is basically almost exactly flat as far as we can see. And by flat, we mean sort of the geometry of a flat surface, if you like, which would, in terms of a sort of, you know, a universe, a real universe, if you look around us, the best way of thinking about that is to think about two laser beams that are set off, pointed sort of so that they're parallel initially. In a flat universe, they stay parallel. Whereas if the universe is curved, they would either diverge or they would converge as they traveled through the universe. So inflation, you know, solved various of these problems. But it would be nice to try and test it. And I suppose, you know, you could argue that some of these observations, like the fact that the universe has been, you know, is almost exactly flat, is, you know, a good test of inflation. So that already exists. Another thing you can look at is when we look at the cosmic microwave background across the whole of the sky, we can measure its temperature. And although we see that it's almost exactly the same temperature everywhere, there are very small fluctuations in the temperature at the level of sort of 1 part in 10 to the 5. So, you know, 1 part in 100 would be 1% fluctuations. So it's 1/1% or less, that sort of level of variation in temperature. Those sorts of fluctuations, you can measure the scales, the sort of sizes on the sky, their angular scale, and if you measured, you know, in degrees, for example. And we see this very clear spectrum of fluctuations where you see peaks in the, you know, you see a large number of fluctuations around about a degree or so across. But then you see a large number of them at rather sort of, if you like, clumping at rather smaller angular scales and so on. And you see these sorts of peaks in the spectrum. And those peaks are what we call the acoustic oscillations. So they're basically due to sound waves rippling through the universe, much like the sort of harmonics you get from a guitar string or striking a bell, where you get these sort of peaks at different frequencies. We see these same sorts of peaks in the temperature fluctuations and therefore the density of the universe. Now, it turns out that you can study the details of those and show that, in fact, they can't have been caused by fluctuations arising continuously during the history of the universe, but they appear to only be explained by fluctuations which were imposed very close to the beginning, very close to T=0, which, again, is something that inflation predicts. So that's something you can more or less tell now from the microwave background spectrum we have, the observations we already have. Now, something like Planck, the Planck spacecraft, will of course measure that spectrum far more precisely and allow us to put further limits on those models. But one of the things that Planck may be able to do, and it's really a may be able to do this, is to measure the polarization of the cosmic microwave background. So polarization in the sense, you know, in a similar sense to, you know, you think about light being polarized and wearing polaroid sunglasses, the radio waves of the cosmic microwave background are polarized because of the way in which they've interacted with scattered off electrons in the early universe. And you can predict, models can predict what sort of type of polarization you should expect. And there's lots of work that, that has been done and will be done by instruments like Planck in terms of interpreting the polarization. But for inflation, one of the key signatures to look for would be something called B-mode polarization, which is a very special class of polarization. And that could really test whether basically caused by gravitational waves resulting from inflation. That could be a real key test of inflation. Now, whether Planck will be able to detect it or not, we will see when the Planck results start to be published from January next year. But it is challenging because only a very tiny fraction of the cosmic microwave background is polarized, and therefore in this way, and therefore you'd have to have very precise observations to be able to detect it above the sort of the noise level, if you like, in the observations. So Planck may do, but there will certainly be other instruments we hope that will be built later, which will, if Planck doesn't manage to measure this, hopefully will be able to measure it. Now, the next question is from Pete, who says, I've understood until recently that the age of the universe was almost exactly 13.7 billion years. But various podcasts and other sources have, in the last few months, started to use a figure of 14 billion years. Do you know of any reason for this change? I can't believe that this is just a matter of rounding all of a sudden. Thanks for your time. Jordan. Well, actually, you might be surprised, but it surely is just a matter of people rounding it all of a sudden, because there's been no, you know, change in any measurements that suddenly says we're, you know, we've gone from 13.7 billion years to 14 billion years. I think people are just rounding it up to the nearest round number of 14. And of course, if you look up the WMAP, the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, from the WMAP website, you'll find the very precise estimates of the age of the universe, even more precise than 13.7 billion years old. So, yeah, you take your pick, but almost 14 billion years is good enough for me. Now, Anne James wrote in to say, hi, all at JB. We just had a lovely Jubilee weekend, caravanning at Knockin in Shropshire. Sounds nice. We were fascinated by the radio telescope there that I understand is part of your Merlin project, and we'd be interested to know what it was tracking. Thanks a million, Anne. So yes, we do have a radio telescope at Knockin. It's part of the Merlin network, as we call it now. And there's actually up to 7 radio telescopes in this network. We've got the Lovell telescope at Jodrell Bank. We've also got the Mark II telescope at Jodrell Bank. But then the remote ones are at Pickmere, which is near Knutsford. There's another one at Darnhall, out towards sort of Crewe Way. There's the one at Knockin, that you mentioned in Shropshire. There's also one at Defford, which is near the Malvern Hills. And there's also one down at Cambridge. So these are basically the ones that we connect together to make effectively a synthesized telescope with a diameter of over 200 kilometers, and that gives us a much sharper view than a single radio telescope alone would give us. So now, yeah, E-Merlin is just the project where we've taken these telescopes that have been around for a while now, and we've completely revamped the whole system, really. The only bit of the array that remains is sort of the most obvious bit, really, which is the dish, the telescope itself. But the receivers that set the focus have been changed, and the way in which that signal is then transported back to Jodrell Bank has been changed. Instead of being on microwave radio links, it now comes back on optical fibers. And then the supercomputer that combines the signal at Jodrell Bank, the correlator, has also been changed as well. So, as I say, the only thing that remains is the sort of metal of the dish, the telescopes themselves. So you can have a look at what E-Merlin is doing on our website. There's a web address, which is www.jb.man.ac.uk, and then /live. And that will show you what all our telescopes are up to, where they're pointing, whether they're operating, whether they're undergoing maintenance or whatever. And right this minute, what E-Merlin is doing, the reason it's not an easy question to answer is because it does change from day to day, often at various points during the day. But we're basically running through doing observations for astronomers all over the world as part of what's called Cycle Zero, which is effectively the very first set of observations we're doing after the new upgrade to optical fibres. And so people have applied for those observations from all over the world, and we're working our way through them now. Okay, the final question this month is from, came via Twitter actually, and it's from at @GGYSPACE, so GGYSPACE, and he says, in less than 140 characters, Sagan states, brackets, cosmos, close brackets, total energy received by radio telescopes is less than energy of snowflake hitting ground. True? Question mark. So, okay, so this gives us a chance to do some calculations, I suppose. It is the sort of thing you hear, and probably was originally, maybe originally was said by Carl Sagan in the Cosmos TV programmes. I guess the main point that underlies this is the amount of energy arriving at the Earth from these cosmic radio sources is very small. So I suppose we could try and do a calculation of that. So I sort of thought I'll see what the answer comes out as here. Well, I picked a bright radio source. So this, I picked Cygnus A, which is one of the brightest radio sources in the sky. It's actually a radio, a distant radio galaxy with radio jets and sort of two lobes where these jets shoot out from the region around a supermassive black hole. And actually it was shown to be a sort of double source where these two jets shoot out by a couple of astronomers at Jodrell Bank back in the early 1950s, Jennison and Dasgupta. So what you need to do is you have to look at the brightness, obviously, of this, of these sources. And you can look at, how much energy is basically arriving per second, from these things. And you have to think about how far away they are. So what, so actually Cygnus A is almost 800 million light years away. So it's a long, long way away. But it produces in the whole of the radio spectrum, it produces about 10 to the 38 watts. So 10 to the power 38 joules per second. So one followed by 38 zeros. So there's a huge amount of energy, but then of course it's so far away that that gets spread over a very large area as it sort of spreads out through space. So if you worked that out and you worked out how much, you know, energy was arriving per square meter per second at the Earth, you get, about 10 to the minus 13 joules per square meter per second. So 10 to the minus 13 watts per square meter, which is basically what you'd get from a 50 watt light bulb if you placed it 6,000 kilometers away. So these things are not bright. Now the thing about that number, in fact, is that that's an overestimate really of what a radio telescope would pick up, because that was the sort of total energy spread across a huge range of the spectrum. So when we use a radio telescope, we tend to have a receiver that is tuned to a very small part of that spectrum, typically. So we're interested, in fact, in what the sort of brightness is at a specific bit of the spectrum. And for Cygnus A, its brightness is what we call 2000 Jansky at a frequency of about 1 gigahertz in the radio spectrum. So a Jansky, obviously named after the Carl Jansky, who was the first person to pick up radio waves coming from outer space, a Jansky is 10 to the power minus 26 watts, so joules per second, per square meter, so arriving at the Earth on an area of size 1 square meter, per hertz, so per sort of frequency unit in the spectrum. So if you then imagine that you've got a receiver on your telescope, that receiver will pick up, will be tuned into a certain bandwidth, a certain section of the spectrum. And a typical sort of old style radio telescope receiver might have had a bandwidth of something like 10 megahertz. So 10 million hertz. So you'd have to multiply up that number of 2000 Jansky by that bandwidth of 10 megahertz. And what that gives you is 10 to the power minus 16 watts per square meter. So, that's about 1,000 times less than the whole of the spectrum. So a very small amount of energy arriving per second, per sort of square meter of your detector. These days, and something that E. Merlin's done is what we've done by using optical fibres, is we've been able to use much higher bandwidths in our receivers. So our bandwidths, instead of being, say, 10, 15 megahertz, are now measured in the sort of gigahertz range, so we can get far more energy in, we can see much fainter things. Well, let's stick with the sort of old style for the purposes of this question. So what you need to do now is you need to say, okay, let's pick the Lovell telescope. The Lovell telescope is 76 meters in diameter. That means it's got an area of about 4,500 square meters. So you take that total area, 4,500 square meters, and you multiply that up by the amount of energy you're getting per second per square meter that we just found from the brightness of Cygnus A. So it turns out that the Lovell telescope, if you pointed it at Cygnus A, would receive about 4 times 10 to the minus 13 joules per second from Cygnus A. So about 10 to the minus 5, 0.00001 joules per year from Cygnus A. So this is not a lot of energy. Remember, a 50-watt light bulb produces 50 joules per second. So this is 10 to the minus 5 joules per year. Now, okay, well, we're supposed to be comparing this to the energy of a snowflake hitting the ground. So let's do that. I now know more about snowflakes than I ever really wanted to know. But the mass of a typical snowflake is a few milligrams, say 5 milligrams. So that's 5 times 10 to the minus 6 kilograms. Snowflakes fall at a meter a second or so, maybe a few meters a second. Work out what the kinetic energy is. That's a half mv squared, where m is mass, v is velocity. You get a kinetic energy for a snowflake of about 2 times 10 to the minus 6 joules. So given all those numbers, that's about 5 times less than the energy that the Lovell telescope would collect from Cygnus A in a year. So the kinetic energy of one, the sort of energy of one snowflake hitting the ground is about 5 times less than what you get in a year from Cygnus A. So I think it's an interesting one. So I would say that it's not clear to me, depends how you work out those numbers, it's not clear to me that it's quite right in terms of the total energy received by radio telescopes is less than the energy of a snowflake hitting the ground. There are, from my calculations, it's about, in a year, it's roughly the same sort of order of magnitude. But of course, you'd have to be pointing continuously at Cygnus A. It depends what bandwidth you assume for your receiver and so on. But I think the bottom line is the amount of energy we get from space collected by a radio telescope, even when we point the Lovell telescope, a huge telescope like the Lovell, at one of the brightest radio sources in the sky, Cygnus A, we're only collecting 0.00001 joules per year, when a single 50 watt light bulb produces 50 joules in a second. So you can sort of see that the amount of energy being received is tiny. Okay, thanks for all those questions. We'll try and answer more questions next month.